We're going to talk a little bit about the role that a jury plays and how that can affect this trial and others. Mary Griffiths is with me, a jury consultant and attorney and founder of Trial Consulting Enterprises, a Dallas-based trial sciences firm. Mary, good morning. Hi, Mary, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Sure.
It's fascinating when you look at, I mean, the whole legal process is, I mean, obviously you know it much better than I do, but it's so complicated and convoluted, and at the same time, you know, working to try to defend the rights of both the accused and anyone who's been hurt. And the role that a jury plays, I think, is something we don't understand very well.
Absolutely.
Can you help us to kind of understand what's happening now with the Blagojevich trial?
Well, as you know, this is his second trial. So now the jury has gotten this last week, and they started their deliberations officially on Monday. And so now we're going to see if the 20 counts, if this particular jury finds him guilty of some of the counts that the previous jury, where there was a mistrial because of a holdout juror, if this jury is going to find him guilty of any of these 20 counts.
As a jury consultant, how do you approach the jury selection process? What is it you're looking for?
Depending on the case, civil case versus criminal case, in this particular case, there's different elements that you would be looking for your jury panel. You would look at life experiences. You would look at how much knowledge they have about the case with it being so highly publicized.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would kind of get a gauge, depending on what they wrote on their questionnaire, where they stand on really important issues for your case.
Mm-hmm. So as the jury selection is going on, then you're consulting whatever firm that is
right.
Contracted with you.
Right. And so if I'm on the plaintiff side, I would be looking for certain jurors, you know, like in this particular case, it's really interesting because we have a majority of women, 11 women and one man, and there's just different arguments on both sides of how that will play into this second trial.
Mm-hmm. Is the makeup of the jury significantly different this time around than last time?
Yes, because it's more a female majority this time.
Okay. And would that have been a deliberate choice on the part of the defense? Would they see that as helping them in some way?
I believe they did. They believed at least that more females could potentially be a little bit more sympathetic to, you know, Blago's plight, if mm-hmm. you will, or in the second phase, a punishment. They could be more sympathetic to his punishment aspect if they found him guilty.
I have and I've never been on a jury, so I'm looking at this completely from the outside, but I have a really difficult time understanding how in a situation like this where, I mean, Rod Blagojevich was caught on tape talking extensively about who he wanted to try to solicit bribes from and what
right.
he would do in return for them. It's hard for me to understand how you'd end up with a hung jury, much less a not guilty verdict.
And I get this question a lot of times, and you know it's because this is a criminal case and it only takes one juror because you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So that one juror, that one holdout juror, turned this whole case around the first time.
Mm.
And so it only takes one. And that's why, you know, sometimes, you know, the public will hear about these large profile cases, and especially if they're criminal, and go, how in the world did that happen? Well, it happens because you just can have one holdout.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have the unanimous vote, then you don't have a conviction.
Mm. Do we have a misunderstanding about what reasonable doubt means?
I believe that there is. I definitely do. And, you know, nowadays with technology being what it is, we're seeing a definite shift in my area in jury research that jurors are looking at. They're wanting hard data. They're wanting the photos. They're wanting what technology has given us. They're wanting that proof, per se, as to show them, yes, this has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. But that's not what the law requires. Beyond a reasonable doubt is just that you've proven beyond a moral certainty that this event occurred.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that I have to show you DNA evidence. It doesn't mean I have to show you photos. It doesn't mean I have to show you any of that. Direct evidence and circumstantial evidence can be the same thing, and that can equal my burden of proof for a prosecution.
And I know that a lot of people in the legal profession will refer to this as the CSI effect.
Correct.
And one of the problems, probably the big problem that we have, is when we're watching a program like that, we're not watching a documentary.
Right.
We're watching a show that takes pretty tremendous liberties with what actually happens at a crime scene.
Exactly. And you're seeing a show that wraps up in pretty much 50 to 55 minutes.
Yes.
So, but what we're hearing from post-trial jury interviews is that expectation that has come about with technology, with what you said about TV shows, et cetera, has now kind of got into the public psyche of, oh, that's what beyond a reasonable doubt means. Mm-hmm. And that's not what it means.
So is this something that typically works for the defense and against the prosecution?
Typically, yes. Yes, so, unless the prosecution has a really hardcore, and if they do, then they are definitely putting that front and center. We've got the DNA. We've got the physical evidence. We've got this, this, and this. We've got our CSI evidence. And so, hence, this is a no-brainer. We've proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
It seems like the O.J. Simpson trial was the first where we really saw that in play. And, of course, we saw the whole thing unfold live on television.
Correct.
But listening to the prosecution talk about it afterward and their frustration with some of the things that went on, it was pretty startling when, at least from their description, what they're saying is we didn't just have circumstantial evidence. We had mountains of physical evidence, and it sort of got ignored.
Sure. But in that particular case, you had other elements that took place. You know, one of the best things that I tell my clients is that trials, although whether or not we like to admit this, they are theaters. Mm. Theaters with definitive consequences. But, you know, the lawyers act as the actor sometimes, and the jury is the audience. And not necessarily do they have an opportunity to, you know, raise their hand and ask questions, but they watch the show, per se, and there's always usually one side that puts on a better show.
Mm.
And definitely in the O.J. Simpson case, there was a show that was being put on, and regardless of the evidence, you had a celebrity, you had a certain venue, you had a leaning towards a theater.
Well, and trying to get Simpson to try on the glove was a monumental blunder on the part of the prosecution.
Correct. And whenever you decide to do something in front of the jury, putting them so that they see it with their own eyes, they hear it with their own ears, you better have a very, very good understanding of how that is, what the outcome is going to be.
Mm. Now, in the Blagojevich trial, you have Rod Blagojevich gave testimony this time, which, if I understand correctly, most defense attorneys would have discouraged him from doing.
Correct. And he was on the stand for, I believe it was 7 days. Mm. He was on the stand for a long period of time, which was much different than, of course, the first trial when he never took the stand. So this is going to be a very interesting element and facet to this case, because would you really want to hear anybody for 7 days, especially a politician who, you know, knows how to talk and knows how to spin different things?
Also, of course, the audio tape. We were talking about this whole CSI effect issue. And, of course, I mean, there's no one's disputing that these tapes are real.
Correct.
But obviously they're trying to sort of assign different meaning to it.
Right.
So what is it that Blagojevich's legal team is saying he was actually doing here?
Well, they're saying that you know, even though he may have asked for something, what did he get in return? He didn't get anything. He didn't receive anything. So hence, was there a crime? This guy's a politician. He's a talker. So he may have talked. He may have said stuff. He may have, you know, just kind of, well, what if I, you know, did this? Could I get that? Did he get anything in return? And so the prosecution's point is that the very fact that you make the demand for this, that is the crime.
Mm-hmm.
That's the fact when you have asked for a personal benefit and you're willing to give state action, you know, appointing them to a, you know, different seat, et cetera, that is the crime. Whether or not you receive something, that's irrelevant. The crime occurred then.
So, again, it seems like we're back to sort of spin. I mean, is the jury going to buy the defense's version of this, that, well, he was just talking a lot and never got anything out of it, or what the prosecution is saying about what the law says about this?
And that is, and it goes back to your original question, that is both the beauty and the beast of the jury system, is that what the jury will understand about the law will be crucial, you know, how they evaluate the law and how they apply it to the facts of this case. But whether or not all of them can agree that that particular, out of all these 20 counts, that all of these counts, you know, the prosecution met their burden, and they have the unanimous verdict of all of them for 20 counts. That's a lot of counts.
That is. Now, as a defense attorney yourself and a trial consultant, does your personal opinion, I mean your professional opinion, in terms of what you think actually happened, once you have the evidence and you've interviewed the defendants and whatever else you've needed to do, does that play into your decision in terms of whether to take a case or how you would go about defending that person?
Well, when I practiced in the civil realm, not the criminal realm. And so I did a lot of on both sides of the aisle, both plaintiff work and defendant's work. And now when I do my jury consulting, and I've done this for over 15 years, I like to take both sides of the aisle cases because it helps me be a better jury consultant when you have a definitive understanding of how each side is going to present strengths and weaknesses. So, yes, I mean, there are definitely some cases that I turned down just because of a personal decision that, you know, I don't want to be involved in that type of litigation.
Mm-hmm.
But I also try to definitely make it a priority to take both plaintiff's cases and defendant's cases because I think it makes you a better consultant in understanding both sides. Mm.
I think that's one of the questions that, you know, a lot of people have as well. You see someone who's done something really heinous and you wonder how in the world do they find someone willing to defend them?
Sure. And, you know, that's something, and I don't do a lot of criminal work.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of just a morality-based decision on my own. You know, you got to go to sleep at night with yourself and you have to do all of that. But as you know, you've met people that some people can detach a little bit more than others.
Mm.
I think you just got to know yourself a little bit and figure out which side you fall on.
So you made a personal decision that at the end of a trial or the end of a consulting case, you want to be able to feel good about your role in this.
Absolutely.
That's,
I mean, that's just me.
And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's certainly important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the big problems, it seems like one of the big problems we have in the legal system is that people are so willing to detach kind of basic morality from strategy.
Right. Well, and I think it's, you know, when you take the oath as a lawyer, it really is your duty that you have to evaluate each case and say, can I give this person or this company 100% of my effort because they are my client and I have fiduciary duties, I've got responsibilities to this client. And if my own personal morality or decisions or experiences could not lend itself to giving 100% to that client, then my duty is not to take that case.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes maybe personal motivations may make you go, well, I can overlook that. But I think at the end of the day, you feel better if you just do that evaluation and say, can I give you 100%?
Mm.
If not, then, you know, the next lawyer probably could.
And that's a long time to be spending immersed in something that you don't feel completely comfortable with.
Absolutely.
I mean, the amount of time that you spend preparing for trial and yeah, it would seem like months on end of going home at the end of the day and saying, wow,
right.
I didn't feel too good about what I did today. That's not a good thing.
Right.
Looking at the Blagojevich situation now as he's waiting for the jury to come back, you mentioned that the heavier female makeup could be good for him. It may be something that the defense was looking for and tried to sort of shoot for during the jury selection.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's impossible to say, well, it's going to fall this way or that way, but do you think there's more likelihood of some of those counts coming back as not guilty?
You know, I think what at the end of the day, I think what the major point is going to be is that, and I know that some experts differ on this, but when he took the stand, and he took the stand for a long period of time, most of the time in criminal cases, when you have that defendant take the stand, jurors want to hear and see from the defendant, look me in the eye and tell me what happened.
Mm.
The fact that he did this time, looked him in the eye and told his side of the case, There is jury research out there that women tend to say, okay, you know, maybe not the action that you did. You may have done wrong, but what really gets me is that when you lie to me.
Mm.
So it will be a fascinating look at to see how these jurors, after 7 days, if they looked at him and got angry that the fact of, you know, we've got the tapes here.
Mm.
Your story, are you lying to our face, to
yes.
our eyes, you know, to our ears?
Mm-hmm.
So it will be an interesting interesting verdict.
Interesting, too, when on the occasions when a juror decides they are going to give some sort of media interview and you get some insights into what was going on during that process.
Right.
And as you mentioned, the last trial came down to one person.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see what those dynamics were, too.
Absolutely.
Well, Mary, great to talk to you. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks. Have a good one.
I've been talking with Mary Griffiths, a jury consultant and attorney, and also founder of Trial Consulting Enterprises, based in Dallas, a trial sciences firm. They're online at trialconsultingenterprises.com. Fascinating stuff. Man, a lot of psychology, a lot of science going into all of that. And, of course, a whole lot of uncertainty because you're dealing with people.